John Scorsese, partner and portfolio manager, founder of Corona Associates Capital Management, makes his debut on the show.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Read through much of your material, and it looks as though you're concerned that U.S. equities may have reached a zenith here. The markets have gotten ahead of themselves. You're concerned about the regime change, the new administration, and that perhaps investors need to be making contingency plans.
Well, I think, you know, we happen to be, Chris, in one of these truly extraordinary moments in time, and that was really the motivating factor for me to get back into the money management business after a decade-plus hiatus where I did not think the opportunities were going to be particularly interesting. And, you know, what always is forefront in my own mind as an investor is, you know, what are those opportunity subsets? And what I had identified was there was a set of circumstances taking place which was not fully understood or appreciated by the vast majority of people out there. And the primary thing that I think people do not understand or do not fully appreciate is where we are in the history of monetary conditions. Just to kind of draw the clock back a little bit, when I started out as a professional in this business, it was 1981. I was a young recruit out of business school, landing my first job at Morgan Stanley, working in the sales and trading area, the equities area. That particular year, I remember, was the year in which the Dow Jones started with an 8. And that 8 was 800. Interestingly enough, gold was also a number that was very near the same number that the Dow was. My perspective on how I look at everything is what is part of my living memory. And that's another point I wanted to make. We are all creatures of our living memory. And it's interesting to note, you know, how much our perspective has changed in that. For example, I remember, you know, sitting in the trading room, and one of the things that was most on people's minds was what happened at 4:15 on Friday afternoons, which was when the Fed released the so-called M1, M2, and M3. That was the data point that was most significant in everybody's mind. So they weren't looking at the unemployment numbers. They weren't looking at the payroll data. They weren't looking at the Fed meeting minutes, the kind of things that our attention is drawn to now. They were looking at the monetary aggregates. And that was important because we had just finished virtually a decade of a highly inflationary period. So inflation was on everyone's mind. And interestingly enough, we don't even look at those numbers anymore. In fact, the Fed doesn't even report M3 anymore. It's a symptom of how things can change. But I would argue that those things are still important. And going back, you know, to the question of what I think is on my mind right now, it is the concept of what people, you know, how they view, for example, the dollar, and how they view financial assets. And the disconnect, I think, for me, is that people don't understand that a dollar is kind of an abstraction. In other words, it is not a static thing. Its value is really determined by what we think of its value. It doesn't have any intrinsic value in and of itself. But investors seem to treat it as if it is some kind of a constant. And if you are a person that believes in financial assets, which is the number one thing that investors or savers are stacking in their portfolio, in other words, this is the thing that we measure our wealth in, this is the thing that we are accumulating. This is the thing that we are fixated on. If you believe in financial assets, you have to understand that you are inextricably linked to the fate of the U.S. dollar. And that is the weakness and the weak point in the whole scheme of things right now. I believe that we are in a period in which you have to question what that value of the U.S. dollar is. And I would argue that what we think of as the value of the U.S. dollar is a number that is greatly overstated. And I could spend some time on that, but basically, one of the things that motivated me to get back into the business was that I felt that that is something that people have not spent enough time considering. In other words, understanding where we came from, understanding the origin of our dollar, what gives it value, and so on, and understanding, most importantly, what happened in 1971 when the U.S. dollar was detached from something that was real, which was essentially the gold in which the dollar was exchangeable into. And when that was no longer the case in August of 1971, you began a set of circumstances that very much explain what happened and the world that we are in right now. I think that that's going to be the most important thing that will determine where we go from here. So we all know what happened in 2008. We had a debt crisis, and I would argue that that debt crisis was never actually fixed. We essentially saved the world by creating more debt and by printing lots of money to save the debt that had failed. And we're at that period right now where I think that we have the possibility of seeing another round of debt fail. And as investors, we have to consider what will be the response to that. And most importantly, we have to consider what has that all done to the value of the dollar. So for investors to believe in financial assets right now, Chris, you've got to basically believe that everything we did in, since 2008, which has been ongoing for the better part of, 8 or 9 years now, namely printing around the world something on the order of $12 trillion of new currencies, whether it's the dollar, whether it's the yen, whether it's the euro, the combined aggregate amount of new money creation is something on the order of $12 trillion. We have also added almost 60% more debt to the total aggregate debt that existed in the world since 2008. So in order for you to believe in financial assets, you have to believe that we have printed all this new money, we have encumbered it with all this new debt, and somehow the unit value of that money has stayed the same. And that is a concept that I do not believe. And so my investment thesis revolves around not financial assets as a store of value, but real assets as a store of value. That investors need to examine what is in their portfolio and what is essentially the risk in the thing that they use as their store of value decaying in value. And I would argue that the dollar has already decayed in value from a fundamental point of view, but that has not been recognized from a perception point of view. So that creates the opportunity out there where we can exchange overvalued dollars for real assets that will perform better as a store of value going forward.
And I wonder, though, if you can give us more of maybe the subtle nuances behind this scenario you've outlined, because, frankly, we all agree with you. I mean, most of the listeners today, U.S. equities, very frothy, but, the trend remains very solid. And these themes tend to persist much longer than pundits I believe they can. For instance, we have had an endless stream of people on the show for many years, since 2009. Call the top on this market. You know, the carcasses of the bears litter the roadway. Also, the U.S. dollar, very strong uptrend, you know, weakness in recent months. Just when do you think the tipping point will be reached? When will folks say, you know what, we've had enough of paper assets, the risk on trade, we're tired of that, let's move back to more solid assets? Give us an idea, please.
I think, Chris, you know, we as investors are a rather impatient breed. So we look at, you know, the timeline of the recent past, especially since 2008, and we say to ourselves, well, why hasn't this turned? Why hasn't the dollar turned? Why haven't equities turned? Why haven't certain things been recognized? When it comes to the dollar, I think that, you know, the world was essentially caught by surprise and at some significant risk in terms of some dramatic change. In other words, where something like the dollar is used to settle an extraordinary amount of global trade, it's in everyone's interest not to have the apple cart upset overnight. So I believe that, you know, we've had rounds of coordinated intervention to keep markets in an orderly fashion. However, you know, 2008 represented a sneak preview of the vulnerability of our international financial system, and in particular, the vulnerability of the dollar. And so I think for everyone that is an actor on the world stage and on the global, you know, trade stage, etc., I think they looked at those circumstances and began to hedge their bets. And if you look at it from that point of view, extraordinary progress has been made to set our world up for alternatives to the dollar since 2008. So you had important actors like China, for example, going around to individual nations and opening up the door to settle bilateral trade using each other's currency other than the dollar. You had things like the Chinese setting up an alternate, you know, international development bank that would compete with something like the World Bank or the IMF to engage in development lending using a currency and a lending institution other than the IMF, other than the World Bank, which is a dollar-centric, U.S.-centric institution. And we now have this Chinese Development Bank, which has begun lending out money, and the assets and the lending that they do is not in U.S. dollars. And we've also even had the vulnerability to people understanding what happens politically if you get into the crosshairs of America in terms of a dispute politically, and how something like SWIFT, which is the world's most important money wiring system, can be used as a sanctioning tool against a country that is not perceived to be, you know, cooperating with U.S.-centric financial systems. So it was used against Iran. It was threatened to be used against other players. And those other players recognized that vulnerability, and they set up an entirely new money wiring system, which is called KIPS, and it's, you know, controlled by the Chinese. And those are not simple things to do. For example, that wiring system, which runs completely outside the U.S. financial system, actually employs undersea cables that crisscross the globe and touch all the major continents without ever interacting with a U.S. cable. So these are extraordinarily difficult and complex things to engineer, but I think it underlies the need for the rest of the world to move away from the dollar. If, in fact, if we look at how much trade is settled today in the U.S. dollar, I believe that number, Chris, right now is running something around 68%. That number in 2008 would have probably been in the high 80% range. So those are significant things. And the amount of trade that is settled in the Chinese currency, going back about 8 years, would have been in the small single-digit range, and that number today is climbing very rapidly, and it is about to breach through the 20% level. So these are actually extraordinary changes, and they act in a way where it removes the structural support for the U.S. dollar. In addition to that, the United States happens to be boxed into a situation, right or wrong, where it is boxed into a structural trade deficit and a structural budget deficit. So that means if you can visualize the U.S. economy, it is an entity which is emitting dollars to the rest of the world. And unless the rest of the world is willing and able on a voluntary basis to absorb the flow of that, you know, emission of dollars, if it doesn't do that, then those dollars begin to literally pile up, and it will begin to impact the unit value on a relative basis of those dollars. And I would argue, now that we've created this, you know, infrastructure away from the dollar, that the circumstances are set up for other people in the world to begin to settle trades in other currencies and to, more importantly, voluntarily choose to use another currency as the currency in which they store value or they store their surplus. And I think an investor who ignores that trend is ignoring that trend at their own peril. And I would also argue that the reason the dollar is overvalued is because it has been stored and used as a store of value by so many other players outside of the United States. If these dollars were to come home like lemmings coming back to the sea, that would be the event that would dramatically impact the U.S. markets. And the most important mechanism for that is literally to change the perceived rate of inflation. And the interesting thing is, investors have a misconception of what inflation is. They think that inflation is what happens when you go to the grocery store and you see that the price of things have gone up. I would argue that inflation, properly defined, is really the act of creating new dollars. And if you look at it in that way, the inflation that you need to create higher prices has already occurred. Those dollars have already been given birth. They exist in places outside of the United States. We have literally, as a nation, exported our inflation to other countries. And if these other countries make other plans, then literally you set yourself up for these dollars finding their way back home and creating the mechanism in which prices begin to change. And they could begin to change in a rather dramatic fashion, and that would have incredible consequences for financial assets, primarily through changes in interest rates. And I believe in a very subtle way, this has already occurred. It is already in the making. We're in that period, that inflection point, where investors are fighting yesterday's battle, in the sense that just as in the 1980s, when I began in the business and people were looking at, you know, an inflationary environment that had taken place in the decade earlier, they did not see the set of circumstances that were going to lead to disinflation and lower interest rates on a secular basis, which is what created the boom in financial assets that continued through the last decade, in a 30-year plus, you know, extravaganza. I think the clock has turned, and now we're going to run that movie backwards. And it comes from interest rates having gone down from a very lofty level all the way to zero. And that zero was achieved through artificial means, We're now seeing interest rates very slowly going the other way, and I think it literally changes the whole picture for financial assets. It augurs the way into this set of circumstances that creates a different perception for the dollar and a different perception for things like inflation rates, which are critical for all investors. And that's where I think the opportunity is. The other set of assets, things like gold, for example, are not on people's radar screen because they don't understand how it fits into all of this. And it also happens to be very under-owned. If you look at things like gold as a percentage of wealth assets, I would argue that, you know, that number is an extraordinarily low number. Historically, it has been probably as much as 25 or 50 times the number that it is now as a share of private wealth. What has changed is that, you know, financial assets has taken the lion's share of people's wealth in terms of a percentage of that. And, you know, I think that that's the thing that's going to change. So our fund is very much geared towards real assets, and we are taking the position that financial assets represent lots of risk with very little return.
We certainly share your thoughts here at GoldSeek. We also concur that the 30-year bull market in bonds has likely peaked. We've seen certainly very large cracks in the foundation of the debt market, and initially the U.S. equities sector has clearly benefited from it, but eventually paper assets will wane. Obviously, investors just can't get enough of shares, despite these valuation levels, etc. Give us an idea of what might get folks to start considering the precious metals and other more solid asset classes.
Well, I think, Chris, you know, that is the number one question, you know, in all of our minds. In other words, you know, what are the catalysts? What is the timing? What are the things to watch? What are the signposts? And I think it all comes back down to the dollar. So it happens to be the thing that I am most closely watching every day for signs that these type of changes are imminent. They are being transmitted into the system. You know, we don't live in a world where we can impose our will on the rest of the world. We might have been in that kind of world a long, long time ago, but we're not in that world. So the rest of the world, they get a vote in how all this plays out. We cannot force them to hold our dollars. And yet, structurally speaking, we're in a situation where our economy depends upon constant emission of new dollars. In fact, the story that I like to give people is, if you were someone on planet Mars and you were studying the world economy on planet Earth, you know, using a telescope and some kind of a sound listening device, I think what you would report back is that there are a bunch of different countries, and they all seem to do different things, they make different things, and they trade different things from one another. But every other country in the world, their income is derived upon what they sell versus what they buy to the rest of the world. In other words, their income is a function of how much more they sell than what they consume. The difference in terms of surplus is what they get to spend on something else. There is only one country on planet Earth that doesn't operate on that matrix, and that country is the United States. The United States gets to consume much more than they produce, and the reason is the United States has had the benefit of owning and controlling the currency that the rest of the world has used for a very long time as a so-called reserve currency. A reserve currency means that is the currency that the world's producers and savers, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia, countries like China, that produce much more than they consume, they need to basically, you know, stack up something. And what they've always chosen as their premier, you know, currency of choice to save in, the United States dollar. So if that were not the case, then the United States wouldn't be able to get away with a circumstance in which they got to enjoy more of the world's resources and goods than they actually earned from, selling things to the rest of the world. So the thing that I think is going to identify a change in all of these circumstances is going to be the value of the U.S. dollar around the world. In other words, what something like the DXY is. The DXY is a common index that we use to measure the U.S. dollar against a basket of other currencies. In the last couple of days, that number has been, weakening considerably. It is somewhere around, 97 and change on the DXY index. The low has been something in the, with a 70 handle that was briefly touched in that period of during the financial crisis. That number happens to be a very leveraged number against other assets. So, for example, I would argue that if we were to see a sudden weakening of the dollar on the DXY index, it would have a leveraged effect on gold prices. In fact, when gold was making its so-called high in September of 2011, the dollar index was considerably lower than where it is now. And the effect on the gold price when the dollar strengthened was essentially taking gold from a high of, call it 1900, down to a low of, call it 1100, which was a rather dramatic price change in relation to the dollar going from high 70s to a number that was around, let's say, 103, 104 on the DXY index. A reversal of that trend, I believe, would have, dramatic impacts on not only the gold market, but on other commodities, the thing that I would call, real things, real assets. So I'm watching very carefully what the value of the dollar is on the DXY as a kind of an early warning system in terms of whether this scenario is happening. And if other people around the world are choosing to de-emphasize the dollar as the reserve currency or the thing that they are saving in, it's going to translate in that index, and it's going to have a dramatic impact on the United States because we won't be throttling back, Chris, our emission of U.S. dollars just because the rest of the world has had enough of it. We're structurally locked in to these budget deficits and trade deficits. So if the dollar begins to basically pile up around the world, it's going to show up as a difference in its value, and that in turn will show up in terms of higher interest rates and higher inflation rates in the United States, which will have an enormous impact on financial assets at a time when investors in general are not expecting that. If you look at how bonds are priced, they are not taking into account the possibility of higher rates of inflation. So that would drive big changes in prices if it were to materialize, and it would drive, great opportunities in terms of things that are not priced in.
John Scorsese, any other parting comments for our listeners today?
I just want to say that I think we are very fortunate to be alive in a very historic time. We saw something that never had happened in the history of 5,000 years of monetary history. And by that, I refer to zero interest rates.
Or negative interest rates, all right? 3.75% at the People's Bank of China. Talk about historic. I don't think the founders of this nation could have even comprehended the implications of solidly negative interest rates.
That literally, Chris, has never happened. And that is a history that goes back 5,000 years. So it basically proves the point that we are living in an historic moment in time. And Just to go back to what I said when I started out in the business in 1981, that period in which the U.S. long bond traded, the 30-year bond traded at a near 15% yield. And that was a opportunity of a lifetime. In fact, I remember the head government bond trader at Morgan Stanley. I was a young recruit sitting on that desk as a trainee. I remember that particular fellow who was a very nice gentleman. Unfortunately, he passed away, you know, on 9/11. He was a senior guy at Cantor Fitzgerald in 9/11. But he had the sensibility of understanding that that was a extremely important period of time. And he took that opportunity to do something that I think very few people would have done, which is, he gave up a very promising career. He was the head trader of the government bond desk at Morgan Stanley. And he gave up his career and went out and raised privately a pool of funds where the express purpose was to buy as much of that 30-year bond as he could get his hands on. Back in those days, it was possible to leverage on a 10-to-1 basis something like a government bond asset. So he left his career, he raised this money. Back then, by the way, I would remind people, the term hedge fund had not been invented yet. What he did was essentially that, but just through family and friends, he raised a number that was probably around $10 million or so, and then he went and bought $100 million of the U.S. long bond, and the rest was history. People didn't see that. Most people didn't see that. When you're at that inflection point where the tide turns, people generally don't get it. And it sometimes takes years before that perception changes. And by the time it does change, the financial landscape has been completely altered. Chris, we are at that kind of inflection point. Similarly to what happened, you know, nearly 40 years ago, the tide has shifted. And when that tide shifts this time, it's going to shift away from financial assets. And it's easy to see why and how. The only thing it takes is for interest rates to go up. And again, I would bring your listeners back into the whole issue of the dollar and whether or not the dollar's value is a static instrument. The thing that I think most people should be thinking about is the question of how can you create more and more and more new dollars, encumber those dollars with more and more and more debt, and somehow you're supposed to believe that the dollar is still worth the same, having done all that, as it was before you started doing all that. I don't believe that's possible, Chris. I just don't believe that. So I'm operating on an assumption that our dollar is overvalued, that investors have ascribed a value on that dollar that is yesterday's battle, yesterday's perception, and the only thing that has to follow now is people's perception. And when they do follow, it will be like, you know, a remaking of the financial landscape. And it will be a shift away from financial assets, and it will dramatically impact the prices of things that we have become used to. And that's where I think the great opportunity lies.
And my guess is you've put some considerable thought into the different avenues and sectors and ways for folks with different backgrounds to benefit from the precious metals. Please tell us more.
Well, I think, Chris, that, you know, the most exciting thing about, you know, the precious metals, and in particular gold, physical gold, is that, number one, it is under-owned. Number two, I believe it is mispriced. And number three, it carries all of the attributes that represent an antidote to the three major risks that an investor faces today. Number one, the risk of debasement. So while you have the world central banks on a campaign of creating an enormous amount of new money, quote unquote, and I believe that that rate of money creation around the world has been proceeding at something like $200 billion per month since 2008. we are seeing the world's money, that what we know of as money, being debased on a constant basis. An investor has to recognize that as a real investment risk. The other risk that investors face is obviously credit risk. It was a credit problem that emerged in 2008 and brought the world's financial system to its knees. What we've done since then is literally combated that problem by creating more debt. So the world hasn't fixed anything. You don't create a solution to a debt problem by creating more debt. So credit is an important risk. Gold, not being a debt instrument, has no credit risk. And then the third thing that we all have to be aware of as investors is the issue of counterparty risk. Physical gold does not represent anyone's counterparty risk because no one needs to perform a promise on that asset in order for that asset to hold its value. So gold has a place in everyone's portfolio simply because of those three attributes. And in addition to that, you know, I believe it happens to be greatly mispriced, because if you look at the stack of wealth instruments that people you know, can identify, whether they are sovereign bonds, whether they are, you know, equities, if you look at the aggregate sizes of all sovereign debt, of all, you know, world equities, they are dwarfed. Physical gold is dwarfed by those other things. And I would argue that gold as a wealth reserve is one of the most important of all of our, you know, wealth assets. Maybe the most important one, because, you know, if you study monetary history, it's kind of like the chicken and egg question. What came first? Was it money or gold? Or was it gold that gave money its value from the beginning? So I think a lot of the keys to the future, Chris, are held in the past, and we need to study what has happened in the past, where we have come from, to get the answers to where we are going. And I don't want to say all roads point to gold, but it certainly points to a higher role for gold as a wealth reserve than what people give it credit for. And it, you know, given the fact that it doesn't have those risk attributes that virtually every other financial asset, wealth reserve has or currency has, it becomes even more important and something that is very worthy of examination. And if these currencies are overvalued and that our debt is problematic, you have to ask yourself, how do we get out of this problem? In other words, in order for us to really solve a debt problem, we have to basically deal with the debt. We know that default is not an option. I mean, the country of Greece was not allowed to default on their debt. When we had a large default in subprime bonds, for example, in 2008, the financial world was brought to its knees, and we had to end up saving that debt failure. So default is not part of the solution. Debasing the money by printing all the money you need to satisfy the debt, if you go that route, then I think it's easy to see that the money will have no value. So where does it leave you? And, you know, you brought up, Chris, the point of these cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, like Bitcoin, etc. We cannot forget the very important fact that gold is a monetary asset that sits on the balance sheet of every major central bank. They are the people that are going to control and decide the outcome of where we go. And I would argue that what is on that asset balance sheet is going to figure into what they need to do. And historically, debt crises have been met by simply revaluing gold, which is another way of saying you devalue your currency. So without going into a whole lot of detail, because it's a subject in and of itself, when people look at the price of gold, it's interesting that they look at it in terms of dollars. But if you believe that the, you know, gold goes down, count, for example, what you're really saying is that the dollar has to go up. Another way of looking at the price of anything is looking at it in terms of, you know, the number of ounces of gold that an asset or a thing represents. So we can basically deal with our debt problem by taking that asset that sits on the balance sheet of the world central banks and revaluing it. And you can revalue it to a number that basically powers over all the debt we've managed to accumulate. So gold could hold the key to how we solve the world's debt problem. And that key basically means that we are going to devalue the world's currencies. And that becomes a possibility, a very real possibility, that figures in a huge way to the future of all financial assets, in the future to interest rates, etc. And it is not a scenario that is priced into gold.
You brought up this idea of parity with gold and U.S. equities in the early 80s. History doesn't always repeat itself, but it has a tendency to rhyme. There are examples in, let's say, modern history, shares market skyrocket in union, if you will, with the precious metals market. We saw that in the Weimar Republic and again in Zimbabwe, and we've seen this in more recent times in Venezuela. Could we see equities skyrocket along with the precious metals?
When it comes to how equities are denominated in dollars, depending on what happens to the dollar, you can, you know, make the price of anything in dollars, whatever it's going to be, depending on what happens to the U.S. dollar. But I would argue when it comes to that, you know, one-to-one parity between gold and equities, for example, which certainly happened in the early 80s, could it happen again? And why hasn't it happened again? One has to also look at what we think of as the gold market. And the problem with how we look at gold is that we look at gold as if it's one thing. And the reality is, our so-called gold market happens to be adulterated by, you know, copious amounts of paper gold, which are nothing more than a financial instrument. So if you look at the actual amount of, for example, gold that trades as a foreign currency hedge, in other words, the XAU, for example, the amount of gold that changes hands on the currency desks around the world, where people use it to hedge currency positions and so on. I remember seeing numbers recently that said that the daily volume was something like $500 billion a day, which actually is kind of a low number when you consider what the volumes of currency turnover, like, for example, the British pound, or the volume of those transactions. So, but the point is, $500 billion a day, the world's mining output is a small fraction of that per annum. So there's no way that $500 billion of physical gold is changing hands every day. What's changing hands are gold-colored pieces of paper that are denominated in ounces of gold, but have no gold collateral behind them. They are merely financial instruments. If you were to take away paper gold and say, you know, we're going to have a market of gold, but it's only physical gold, then what would be the value of that gold if it were to be required, physical gold was to be required to meet the demand that investors have for gold as an asset? And I would argue it would already be one-to-one with the equities market. Now, what would it take for that to happen? You would need to have some kind of a default in the paper gold market. We haven't seen that happen, but it goes hand in hand with the possibility of default in other paper instruments or debt instruments, which paper gold has to be viewed, Chris, as a debt instrument. It's not physical gold. I mean, all the reasons an investor should hold gold would steer them away from holding paper gold, because if you hold paper gold, you are not getting prevention of credit risk. You are not getting the prevention of counterparty risk. And I would argue you're not getting the prevention of debasement risk. So what is that paper anyway? The remarkable thing of our time, this historic time, is that investors haven't even bothered, Chris, to make the distinction between paper gold and physical gold. So if you go to the so-called gold store, there's two tellers. One sells actual bricks of gold that come out the window, and the other guy, the other teller is pushing out pieces of gold-colored paper that are denominated in ounces. They trade at the same price. And I find that to be remarkable because in the world of, for example, municipal bonds, for example, we pay attention to things like collateral. So things that have more collateral behind them are priced differently. But apparently, paper gold that has no collateral is priced the same as physical gold. I would love to have someone explain that.
It seems to me as though the scenario you're painting for us here today is rather ominous, because what keeps popping into my mind, another 2008-like crisis, you know, at that time it was mortgage-backed securities, and investors were frantically searching for the balance sheets and where have they hidden these weapons of financial mass destruction. Anyone who figured that out early made absolute fortunes if they purchased the credit default swaps and whatnot. But the real key here, as we look forward, what is encumbered? Where is the debt? What is real? What is tangible versus paper promises? All right, John Scorsese, I wonder if you could tell people more, please, about Corona Associates Capital Management and just what they'll find at your website.
Well, thank you, Chris. It has been a real pleasure. And for anyone that is interested in what we are doing, I would encourage them to visit our website, which is www.coronacap.com.
We'll look forward to having you back on Gold Seek.
This has been a real pleasure for me, and I hope to have another chance to dialogue with you again.